Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. On the one hand, we see $27 offers to fly to Dallas. On the other, we see the cheapest airfare between Milwaukee and Las Vegas or L.A. at $400 or $500 round trip, which is the same price it costs to get from L.A. to Sacramento sometimes in the same state. Our guest today says we should get used to airfares going up, not down. The era of cheap flights is ending. Brian Summers is the airline business reporter for the travel industry news website Skift. Brian, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
We are also taking your calls on this, 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. So, Brian, why do you think cheap flights are coming to an end? This makes me very sad.
Well, it's pretty simple, right? Depending on how you count it, fuel prices are probably up about 40% year over year. It doesn't matter what kind of business you run, whether it's a bakery or an airline. If the cost of your number one ingredient, shall we say, goes up 40% in a year, you have to pass that cost along. And what airlines are doing is they're charging people more to fly. And I do think it's going to get worse over the next year or two, unless fuel prices go down. It's sort of interesting, right? Because airlines just don't have that much control over fuel prices. They don't know what fuel is going to do in a year any more than we do.
Do airlines buy fuel in advance?
So most airlines basically don't buy fuel in advance. There is one airline out there, Southwest Airlines, that hedges its fuel. And so they're committing to buying fuel in advance at a set price. So they have a little bit more understanding of what their fuel price is going to be. And so if fuel goes up by $40 or $50 from now, Southwest will be insulated against that. People talk about that as insurance, just like on your house or your car. Insurance is pretty expensive. And the rest of the airlines say, you know what, we're just going to buy fuel as we need it. And we're not going to worry about what it's going to cost a year or two or three in the future.
Okay. So when you say cheap, do you mean affordable for the average person? Or do you mean like dirt cheap, like these $27 flights to Orlando or something?
You know, it's funny. We may still see some of these $27 flights to Orlando. People who fly airlines know that these tickets are priced according to supply and demand. Orlando can be very hot in July. I once lived in Florida. I know that. Mm. It rains a lot. People just don't want to go to Orlando at certain times of the year, especially if kids are in school or whatnot. So if you want to fly from Milwaukee to Orlando in January when the kids are back in school on a Tuesday afternoon, you might score a cheap price. But if you want to go home to California or you want to go visit New York and you want to go over Christmas or Thanksgiving, forget about it. You know, everybody knows that a lot of passengers want to travel at those times. And I hate to use the term jack up the prices because it's just supply and demand. But if you want to go somewhere when other people want to go, you have to expect airlines are going to raise their prices as much as they possibly can.
Okay, so are we going to see this in the ticket prices themselves, or are we going to see it in things like fees for extra carry-ons?
We will probably see it mostly with the ticket prices themselves. On the margins, we might see some fees change. Just this morning, I saw a pretty interesting thing. It looked like United was going to charge for some seats that are now free. So seats in the back of the airplane that don't even have extra legroom, but maybe they're on the aisle. And it looks like United's going to charge extra for them. American already does that, so it's not that rare. But yeah, I mean, I think you're going to see airlines basically turning over their couch cushions trying to find that extra 10 cents.
And this is all related to fuel. Is there anything else that is driving this?
You know, it's mostly related to fuel. It's a huge cost for airlines. And when that cost goes up 40%, this is what happens. I think it's important to note, though, that we get real excited about higher fuel prices. Historically, they're not that high. They were almost or they were more than twice this much back in 2008 and mm-hmm. 2009. And that's when airlines really scrambled to make money. I'm not sure that we would have seen a charge for a first check bag, the one that we have on every airline now, if not for the fuel price of 2008, 2009. At that point, fuel prices went up so quickly and airlines couldn't recover them that they said, oh, no, we need new fees. So in 2008, when fuel prices spiked, one day American Airlines decided they needed to recover that cost, and they passed it on to consumers in the form of bag fees. And unfortunately, we still have those bag fees now, even though fuel cost a lot less than it did in 2008.
So that tells me that if they raise their prices now because of fuel, they will never go back down.
You know, you don't know that. People could have said that in 2008 and 2009 when airlines were raising their prices to recover the increased prices of fuel. And I think people probably noticed in 2015, 2016, and 2017 some pretty insanely cheap prices, you know, sub $30 to go down to Florida, prices that we never would have thought we would have seen 8 or 9 years ago.
Do higher prices mean the airlines don't fly as many routes?
Yes, that is true. Because this is a supply and demand industry, one of the best ways to raise your prices is to reduce the supply in the market. So before you and I spoke here, I just took a look at one market from Milwaukee to New York LaGuardia on Delta Airlines. Most days, Delta flies 5 times a day from Milwaukee to New York LaGuardia, and fares are okay. But if you really wanted to raise your prices, the best way to do that is not charge more for the seats on your 5 flights. It's to drop it to only 4 flights. You have less supply. Presumably, demand stays the same, and prices go up. Generally, that's the way airlines do it.
So is there any other way for airlines to deal with this without charging us more?
I'm not sure they can. I mean, just as I said before, you take any business,
issue.
Right? Any business, you know, the cost goes up. The cost of the consumer is going to go up.
So, what do consumers do about this? And what are we talking about in terms of how much will it cost me to fly to Las Vegas or Los Angeles or New York or Atlanta from
this
Milwaukee?
This is the million-dollar question, right?
It won't cost me $1 million. Please don't say it'll cost me $1 million.
No, it won't. It's impossible to know how much a ticket is going to cost in advance. The best way to score cheap deals is probably to fly at times that other people don't want to fly. So red eyes tend to be cheaper. 5 a.m. departures tend to be cheaper. Tuesday might be cheaper because business travelers don't fly on a Tuesday. That's one thing. The other thing that's probably a little bit depressing for people to think about in Wisconsin is the bigger the airport, the more competition there is. And I'm going to guess that if you drive down to Chicago, you will probably almost always see better fares than from a place like Milwaukee.
But that may be eaten up by our parking. We will see. Brian Summers is the airline business reporter for the travel industry news website, Skift. Brian, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for the time.
Still ahead on the morning show, we have a discussion about securing housing while making minimum wage. Is that even possible? We want to hear from you. Have you held a job that paid minimum wage? Maybe you earn that now. How did you find a place to rent on that income? Was it safe for your family? Did you manage to save any money making minimum wage? Or did you have to pick up extra hours to make ends meet? Call us. Tell us your story. 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org or find us on Twitter. That is WPR Mornings. We want to hear your minimum wage story, how you got out of it, and how you are maybe dealing with it now. Where are you living? Our affordable housing and wage conversation is just ahead. It's The Morning Show. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. 25 years ago, you could find a decent one-bedroom apartment in Milwaukee or Madison for under $500. Today, that same apartment is three times as much, at least. But minimum wage has not gone up since that time, really. So how do people making minimum wage, or even just above that, afford housing for their families? Our guest today says they don't. Diane Yentl is the president and CEO of the National Low Income Housing Coalition. Her group put out a study, Out of Reach, the High Cost of Housing, earlier this summer. Diane, welcome to the program.
Hi, Carrie. Thanks for having me.
So what was the goal of this study? Is this the first one you've ever done?
No, actually, this was the 29th year.
Ah, there you go.
Out of Reach, yeah. And the goal of it is always to educate the public and policymakers about the gap between what people are earning and what it costs to rent a decent apartment.
So when was the last time minimum wage was raised?
Oh, it's been many, many years. And even just by cost, by the inflation rate, it continues to actually lose value over time.
And where did you get the data for this report?
Well, the data comes from the HUD's fair market rents, which are the Department of Housing and Urban Development's kind of best estimate of what a family moving today can expect to pay for a modest rental home. And we look also at the fair market rents is typically the 40th percentile of rents that a family can expect to pay. So we base on the fair market rent estimating that a household would pay no more than 30% of their income towards their housing costs, which is what experts agree. I mean, none of us should be paying more than 30% of our income towards our housing costs. And when we put that together, we come up with what we call the housing wage, that is how much somebody has to earn an hour working full-time in order to rent a modest home, paying no more than 30% of their income towards their rent.
And how much?
So this year, in 2018, the national housing wage nationally is $22.10 an hour to afford a modest two-bedroom apartment, and about $18 an hour to afford a one-bedroom apartment. So there's actually no state, no metro area, no county, even those where the minimum wage has been set above the federal level, where a minimum wage worker working 40 hours a week can afford a modest two-bedroom rental unit. And in fact, in just 22 out of 3,000 counties nationwide, can they afford a modest one-bedroom apartment?
We are talking about affordable housing, especially if you make minimum wage. We're taking your calls here, 800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. So, Diane, you've been doing this study for 29 years. Has anybody been listening to you in government?
Well, I mean, yes and no. I think we're seeing that certainly the housing crisis is intensifying. We've reached historic heights at this point, and it's most negatively impacting the lowest income people. I think that increased need and severity of the crisis is getting the attention of policymakers more and more because they're hearing more and more from their constituents that housing costs are out of reach for them. So I do think we're starting to see more of an urgency around putting forward big, bold ideas, and we're starting to see a willingness to invest in the solutions to make homes affordable for the lowest income people.
We're going to get to solutions.
But we still have a long way to go.
Okay, so we're going to get to solutions in a minute. I want to get back to this report. Give us a range here. What is the highest wage a renter would need to be able to pay their rent in, say, Chicago, as opposed to Kansas City, as opposed to Phoenix?
Well, the highest housing wage in the country is in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
It's over $60 an hour in order to afford a two-bedroom apartment there. In Wisconsin, the housing wage is quite a bit lower than San Francisco, for sure, and even lower than the national housing wage. State of Wisconsin, the housing wage is about $16.52 an hour for that two-bedroom apartment. But even in Wisconsin, there's a range. So Madison, Minneapolis have significantly higher housing wages, closer to $21 an hour, whereas Milwaukee, Kenosha County, Columbia County, also higher than the state average, Their housing wage is around $1,750 an hour for that two-bedroom apartment.
So in the urban areas, it costs more. Are there places in urban areas that cost a lot less, and the average kind of averages out because there are wealthier people there?
Typically, the urban areas have the higher housing wages. But I think the thing that's important to recognize is that the balance or the gap between the wages and the housing costs remains about the same throughout the country. So even in the rural areas where the housing wage might be lower, typically, you know, the housing costs are lower, the housing wages might be lower, but there's still that gap between what they can afford and what the rents actually cost.
Because they're making less money.
Exactly.
So how many people are we talking about here in the U.S. that actually struggle to pay the rent in this way?
Well, one way we look at how are people struggling to pay the rent is, are they what's called cost burdened? So are they paying more than 30% of their income towards their rent each month? Another way to look at it is looking at whether people are what's called severely cost burdened. In other words, they're paying more than 50% of their income towards their rent each month. And in the case of severely cost-burdened renters, there's more than 11 million households throughout the country that are in that situation today. And, of course, there's hundreds of thousands more that have no homes at all. So those extremely low-income households who are paying half of their income towards rent each month, you know, they're facing housing instability. They're, you know, one illness, one divorce, one paycheck away from not being able to pay the rent and facing potential eviction and homelessness. And in the meantime, they're having to make really tough trade-offs between, you know, paying the rent or buying the medication they need, or
groceries,
paying the rent, or, right, buying the healthy food for their kids.
And are these people, first of all, 11 million seems low to me in some way. I feel like I've seen 11 million people dealing with this in Chicago alone.
Uh-huh. Well, it depends on how you're measuring it. The severe cost burdened, if we're looking at extremely low income households, so, you know, these are seniors, they're people with disabilities, they're families with kids, and they're working really low wage jobs. There's about 8 million extremely low-income households nationally that are severely cost-burdened. There's nearly 10 million that are cost-burdened. In other words, they're paying more than 30%. And then when you go up the income scale, it's a decreasing number of people that are facing those severe cost burdens. But even when you look at people who are very low-income, you know, there's about 5 million that are cost-burdened. People who are low-income, there's another 4 million. So when you add up the income ladder, it does increase in number.
And so we're talking about can you pay your rent or do you have to buy groceries and the choices that you have to make. Are the people who you're talking about eligible for SNAP benefits?
Yeah, some of them are. Some of them receive other benefits as well. But they're so low-income. If you're talking about a household that is, let's say, senior or has a disability, and they're on a fixed income, they're getting SSI disability insurance or something like that, they're earning somewhere around $10,000 to $12,000 a year. So even with additional benefits that they might receive elsewhere, with housing costs being as high as they are, they still can't afford the rent.
And we're talking usually one income family. What if we have two incomes in a family?
Similarly, so sometimes we get that question about, you know, why are we talking about two-bedroom apartments? Why not? Would a single person try to rent a two-bedroom apartment? The two-bedroom apartments we look at, they're the most common rental home size, and the data from those two-bedroom apartments are the most reliable. But certainly, and single-wage earner families with children need at least those two bedrooms. But if you look at the number of hours that a minimum wage worker or even, you know, an average renter would have to work an hour, it's often multiple jobs to be able to make those ends meet. And even two jobs in many cases isn't enough. So at the national level, where we have the housing wage is over $22 an hour to afford that two-bedroom apartment, a minimum wage worker, and you know, these are their child care workers, their nurses assistants, their emergency medical technicians, right, people we rely on and interact with every day in our community, they'd have to work $122 a week for 52 weeks of the year, which is three full-time jobs, to afford that modest two-bedroom apartment. And they'd have to work nearly 100 hours a week, or 2.5 full-time jobs, to afford a modest one-bedroom apartment.
Yeah, so if we're talking about that, if we're talking about the housing wage being $22 nationally, $21 in the urban areas of Wisconsin, and $7.25 is the minimum wage, even if you do have two people working, they're not making that 20. They're making about $15 an hour, a little less than $15 an hour at the same time. So, my question here is that policymakers are looking at this?
Policymakers are looking at it to different degrees in different areas. You know, there's a whole host of solutions that are necessary, right? Federal, state, and local policy makers have a role to play.
Okay, we're going to get to that in a moment. We are talking to Diane Yentl. She is the president and CEO of the National Low Income Housing Coalition. She stays with us as we consider solutions to the high cost of housing. It's The Morning Show. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Minimum wage does not buy you minimum housing in most of the U.S. This adds to the homeless population. It also wreaks havoc with schools in low-income areas, as many students move around and have to restart at different schools year after year. Diane Yentl of the National Low-Income Housing Coalition is taking us through how this works, or doesn't in this case. Her group put out the study, Out of Reach, the High Cost of Housing, earlier this summer. We're taking your calls on this. Are you having trouble making ends meet? Is housing costing you too much? 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org, or you could tweet us at WPR Mornings. Now, Diane, we left talking about policy. Specifically, do you know what we are considering here in Wisconsin?
Well, the thing about the housing crisis, especially when it comes to looking at the lowest income people, is that there's essentially a market failure there. Developers can't build and operate homes, rental homes, that are affordable for the lowest income people, because the amount that they can afford to pay for rent doesn't cover the cost of operating that home. So that's basic market failure. And that's where the government needs to step in to correct for a market failure. And the scale of investment necessary to solve this crisis for the lowest income people is really the federal government's responsibility. There are a number of federal housing programs that serve low-income people, about 5 million people today who get federal housing assistance that helps them afford their homes, pay the rent each month. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the needs of many more families go unmet. And we actually have a housing system today where just one in every four low-income people who need housing assistance and are eligible to get it receives any. So about 75% of the people who need housing assistance, they don't get any at all. They're the ones who are adding their names to, you know, years or decades-long waiting lists, mm-hmm. hoping to win this housing lottery.
Right.
So what's most needed is for the federal government to fund the solutions at the scale necessary, even at the scale like we used to, like the federal government used to decades ago, and at a time when we actually had a surplus of homes affordable and available to the lowest income people, back at a time when we were funding the solutions at the scale necessary. So that's what's most important.
Okay, so wait a second. Talk to me about that time when we were funding these solutions. Was that?
If you'd have to go back to the late 70s to find a time when there was actually the homelessness that exists in our country today didn't exist back then.
Okay.
Having, you know, people living on the streets and in shelters and in their cars, that's a modern phenomenon that was created through budget cuts, really, that started in the late 70s and early 80s. So in the late 70s, we had President Nixon established a moratorium on building any new deeply affordable apartments through public housing or other programs like that. We stopped building those units back in the late 70s. And then in the early 80s, President Reagan slashed the budget for the Department of Housing and Urban Development he slashed it by about half. And he deeply cut programs that served the lowest income people. So since that time, we've had some new federal housing programs created, but none have been funded at the scale that they were back then, and none have been as deeply targeted to the lowest income people as they were back then. So back then, we actually had a surplus of apartments that were affordable for the lowest income people. Today, nationally, there's a shortage of over 7 million affordable homes for those lowest income people.
So you're saying this very clearly, that it were political decisions in the 80s made the homeless population swell.
Absolutely. I mean, it was only years after the HUD budget was cut to the degree that it was that we suddenly had to have a new influx of federal resources, of investments into shelters and into all of the other expenses that come when people are homeless or when they're severely cost burdened.
And this costs us more or less than what we were spending just helping people find housing through HUD in the 80s?
Yeah, great question. It costs us far more today. Homelessness is far more expensive to us as a country. I mean, not even to speak, of course, of the expense to those families and to the children and to their futures. But just looking in a purely economic sense, we spend far more when people are homeless than we would otherwise to keep them housed. There was a study recently that came out from Children's Health Watch, a group of pediatricians out of Boston, that showed that as a country, over 10 years, we'll spend $111 billion in avoidable health care costs because people are unstably housed or homeless. So if we were to spend that money instead on housing people, we would actually save money in the health care system.
Okay, so you run the National Low Income Housing Coalition. I am sure you've had people say to you, why don't these people just get better jobs? Why don't these people just get educated? What do you say to that?
Yeah, we do hear that often, and I'd say a few things about that. One is that we're all impacted. When people are unable to afford their homes, it creates a downward spiral for an entire community. And the costs, as I was just saying, the healthcare sector is one example of where we as a country overspend in order to make up for the fact that we're not assisting people afford their homes in the first place. But there's so much research to show really just how central housing affordability is to the outcomes of so many other sectors and so many other aspects of all of our lives. So when people are affordably housed, they are healthier. Their kids do better in school. They earn more over their lifetime. They even live longer. So affordable housing in a community assists those individual families and those kids, but it also makes the entire community healthier, and we save money as a federal government. We also just have to recognize the way our economy works and that we have very low-wage workers. And even when we successfully increase minimum wage in some communities throughout the country, even when that occurs, still the housing costs are too high. There's a disconnect. It's not that people aren't working hard enough. Mm-hmm. It's that wages don't pay enough to cover the costs of housing. It's an issue, too, I should say, you know, not just for minimum wage workers. The average renter in the country earns about $17 an hour, which is, you know, about $5 less than that two-bedroom apartment costs. So that average renter earns enough to afford a two-bedroom apartment in just 11% of U.S. counties, and they can afford a one-bedroom apartment in half of U.S. counties. So people are working, and they're working very often very hard. The housing costs exceed what they can afford, and that's not even to speak of seniors and people with disabilities who may not be able to work and are on very limited incomes, and the housing costs are far out of reach for them.
Okay, we're going to get to that disconnect in a second. I want to take a John from Three Lakes. John, welcome to the program.
Hey, I was just wondering, you mentioned a couple of the cities that were having problems, San Francisco, Chicago. Can you name a couple of the other ones?
Well, the thing about the housing crisis, and especially for the lowest income people, is that it exists everywhere in the country. So one way we look at the crisis is we actually quantify the shortage of homes that are affordable and available for the lowest income people. So nationally, there's a shortage of over 7 million homes for those lowest income people. Another way of looking at that is for every 100 of the lowest income people, there are just 35 homes that are affordable and available to them. Mm. Now, there's some places that have a more severe shortage. Wisconsin is one of them. Texas, Florida, Colorado, California, all of them have shortages even more severe. So in Wisconsin, for every 100 of the lowest income people, there's just 28 homes that are affordable and available. But even when you look at rural communities or communities that are not on the coasts, so Kansas, Missouri, Arkansas, Minnesota, Alabama, all of them have less than half of the homes necessary for all of the low-income people who need them. So it's really a pervasive crisis that exists in big cities, in suburbs, and in rural areas across the country.
Thank you very much, John. Rural areas across the country, are rural areas facing this harder, or are they better off, perhaps?
Well, again, it's relative, right? I'd say that rural areas, so for example, let's say in Mississippi, for every 100 of those lowest income people who need an affordable home, there's just 57 homes that are affordable and available. So that's less severe than in Wisconsin, where there's less than 30 homes, mm-hmm. but it's still quite a significant shortage of homes. And even in those rural areas, you can find that housing costs are significantly at times less than what housing costs in the big cities, but people are also paid less in those communities. So the difference, the idea of people moving to, very poor people just moving someplace in order to find housing that's affordable to them, we find that for the lowest income people, those places where they can afford the rent just don't exist.
And they can't afford to move. I mean, that's the other part, is that to move would create even a bigger burden on them and their housing needs.
Sure, there's a lot of expenses associated with moving, and also moving away from maybe social support networks that make life possible when you are so poor and having such a difficult time making ends meet.
We are talking to Diane Yentel of the National Low Income Housing Coalition. We're talking about the difference between the disconnect between what people make and what people need to pay for affordable housing. We're going to be back with Diane in a moment. It's The Morning Show. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Housing prices have risen in the last couple of generations, but incomes have really not. So more people can't afford homes for themselves or for their families. According to the study, Out of Reach, the High Cost of Housing, we are talking to Diane Yentel, who is the author of that study, and she runs the Affordable Housing Coalition. And we're taking your calls, 800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Diane, I want to talk a little bit more about this disconnect that we see here. Is there a greater disconnect in different states? And I'm talking specifically red states, blue states. Does California do this better than, say, Mississippi?
No, again, in terms of the shortage for the lowest income people exists at different scales, but pretty significantly in Mississippi and in California. There's definitely differences in how the housing crisis sort of looks and feels and what the specific local solutions could be in different communities. So California is a good example of a state where the local zoning laws are so restrictive that in many communities, any kind of multifamily developments or apartments aren't being built. And so even at the higher income levels, the supply is not nearly keeping up with the demand for apartments, which is leading to really high housing costs. That's an example of where local communities have an important role to play in looking at their zoning laws and finding ways to ensure that apartments are being built at all income levels to meet the demand that exists. That will relieve some of the upper pressure on costs for higher income people in the rental market. It still won't alleviate the needs of the lowest income renters. That's where the federal government has an important role to play in investing in the solutions there. But cities and states certainly have an important role to play in looking at local zoning and looking at ways to increase state and local resources for some of the housing solutions to build more apartments affordable for low-income people or create rental assistance for low-income people.
We are taking calls today, 800-642-1234. You still have a few minutes left. Jeremy from Racine, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I recently just read a book named Evicted. It pretty much bases stories of families here in Milwaukee, southern Milwaukee, and the perpetual problems dealing with evictions for low-income individuals is pretty bad. Milwaukee has a law, ordinances for nuisance tenants. So if you have a tenant who calls the police department on several occasions throughout a month for any given period of time on a domestic problem, they basically put pressure on landlords to rectify the situation. In most cases, they just evict everybody from the property. And once you get an eviction on that individual, it's incredibly hard for them to find a new place to live in because they have a permanent record of an eviction. So, I mean, there's a lot of laws, I think, on the books that can deal with a lot of evictions, homelessness that's within, city of Milwaukee or throughout the country in general, laws that are more, seems like to be catered to the landowners more so than the tenants. And tenants tend to fear to hold their landlords accountable for things for the fear of being put back out on the street.
That's interesting. Thank you very much, Jeremy. So how do you speak to that, Diane? Go ahead.
It's a great point, Jeremy, and thanks for raising it. And Evicted is a terrific book if any of your readers haven't read it and are looking for a way to really understand the housing crisis and how it's impacting people in your communities. I highly recommend reading Evicted. Matt Desmond's done really important work with that. And one of the things, exactly as Jeremy noted, that I think the book helped bring to light is this challenge with nuisance laws. It's, you can imagine how it would be particularly challenging for people who are suffering from domestic abuse, who then fear, as he said, calling the police because it could result in their own eviction, and then all of the challenges that arise from that. So there are some communities that are starting to look at the challenge with nuisance laws and to overturn them. There's also challenges with in eviction court. There's a very high number of tenants who go to eviction court without any lawyers, where their landlords certainly have very good lawyers. And so there are an increasing interest among local communities. New York City was the first to pass a law that is a right to counsel law that provides all tenants who go to eviction court with an attorney to help defend them. Another example of a local law that can have a real impact on people's ability to get into homes they can afford is something that's called source of income discrimination. So landlords can sometimes reject tenants who have federal rental assistance in the form of a Section 8 voucher, and they can reject them because they have a voucher. So then they have they struggle to be able to find apartments where they can use that rental assistance. So increasingly communities are looking at banning source of income discrimination. So Jeremy's absolutely right. There's a number of really important ways that cities, counties, and states can pass laws to make the whole atmosphere of renting in that community easier and more just for low-income people.
You know, we actually had a call, a caller or somebody tweeting us, Katie from Madison, talking about how low-income housing, and I'm assuming that that she includes in their Section 8 housing, affects neighborhoods. Does it attract people? Is there a correlation between the people who come with Section 8 vouchers and crime?
No, actually, that's been pretty well debunked by research that shows that there is no correlation between Section 8 voucher holders moving into a community and any increased crime. The challenge that we find with Section 8 voucher holders actually often is that the way that the rents are set at the federal level often requires them to continue living in poor and often segregated communities rather than allowing them the opportunity to move into communities that maybe have better schools or less crime or access to transportation and jobs. So there are some changes that are being considered at the federal level to make it to make the worth of those vouchers high enough that low-income tenants could be able to move into those so-called higher opportunity neighborhoods to have all the amenities and access to opportunity that they offer.
So there are two bills before Congress right now, the Rent Relief Act and the Home Act. Tell us what they would do.
Sure. So those are two recent bills that were introduced by Senator Kamala Harris from California introduced the Rent Relief Act, and Senator Booker introduced the Home Act. Both of them would create a new renter's tax credit. They have slightly different ways of going about it, but essentially it would assist people who are cost-burdened, who are paying more than 30% of their income towards their rent. It would provide a tax credit to cover the burden, that cost burden, between what they're paying, the burden itself, they're paying over 30% of their income towards their rent, up to a fair market rent, and they cap the fair market rent differently. But basically, it would put money back in the pockets of low-income people who are struggling to afford their rent. And Senator Booker's bill also includes a really important provision that would that gets at that inclusive zoning policies that I was talking about earlier, and it would require states and local communities to look at their zoning policies and create more inclusive zoning policies that increase the affordable housing supply overall.
We have been talking to Diane Yentel. She is the president and CEO of the National Low Income Housing Coalition. She put out the 29th. This is your 29th year putting out this study?
Yeah, that's right.
The 29th year, Out of Reach, the High Cost of Housing. This came out earlier this summer. Diane, in 20 seconds, are you hopeful that this will get solved in your lifetime?
I am absolutely hopeful. The thing about the affordable housing solution is that we have the data, we have the resources, we have the solutions. We lack only the political will to fund those solutions at the scale necessary, and together we're working to build that political will. So, yes, we can solve this crisis if we choose to.
Thanks for being with us, Diane.
Thanks for the opportunity.
I'm Carrie Kaufman. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.